Welcome to Behavioral Science Uncovered, the podcast about behavioral science and how it's made.
Hello, everyone. Today we are talking to Ran Spiegler, a professor from Tel Aviv University and the University College of London. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Ran.
Thank you very much, Jonas. Thanks for the opportunity.
We will talk about a chapter of your upcoming book called The Curious Culture of Economic Theory. And could you give our listeners a brief overview what this book is going to be about?
Thanks. So the book Curious Culture of Economic Theory, it's coming out in April this month and published by MIT Press. And it's a collection of essays about the professional culture of economic theory, modern economic theory. I would like to think that it's a kind of a new way of writing about economics and certainly about economic theory. The essays are independent, so you can read them one at a time. There are running threads. I'll mention that later. Most chapters, what they do is that they take one or more classics from economic theory from the last 2-3 decades, and they do two things. First, they give an accessible but precise exposition of those models. That by itself has pedagogical value. If you teach a course in theory, then it would be like a useful supplement. But then the main thing is not just to present those models, but to surround them with a very subjective and very elusive and hopefully entertaining discussion of the piece's rhetoric, their style, the gambits that authors use in order to enhance the impact of their work, modeling choices, and broader, I would say, cultural trends that these stylistic choices reflect. So I think it's a new way of writing about economics. Like, for example, one running thread is the tension between pure and applied styles of doing economic theory and writing, the kind of pressures that we're getting from the broader discipline, from other economists, the obsession with top 5 publications. So I'll just give 2 illustrations. So one book chapter is called The Applied Theory Style. It takes a few classics and it basically tries to argue how authors try to use various expositional tactics to enhance the applied impression of what they do. Another chapter is called The Path of Least Theory. It's about how subfields, like behavioral economics, for example, choose to kind of pick a location on the pure applied spectrum. So these are just examples to illustrate what this book is doing.
Yeah, sounds very interesting and also really fitting to the spirit of our podcast, which is also more about how research is done and not about the actual results. So what motivated you to write this book?
So I've always loved nonfiction writing. I'm a compulsive consumer of not just popular science, but kind of scholarly work. Even when I don't fully understand what they do, I like reading it. So I always wanted to do something like that, do some kind of writing about economics where the writing per se would take a bigger role than what we usually experience when we write for journals. Then I was an editor at TE for a number of years. I was co-editor and then chief editor. So that was like over almost effectively 6 years. And so you get to see hundreds of submissions every year, even if you don't carefully read everything. It gives you a very good vantage point in terms of getting a feel for broad cultural trends in the professions. And then, of course, COVID came and was a huge catalyst because everything went haywire. And then different people reacted differently to the pandemic. I mean, certainly there were the logistics. I mean, schools were closed, cafes were closed, airports were closed. So the usual ways of doing things were all screwed up. And also, like, emotionally, you sort of feel like this is a crazy moment. You want to do something different. So some people just said, let's put everything aside and let's try to help society get rid of this thing or cope with this thing. Given my temperament, my response was more introspective. And writing this book was kind of an act of introspection, but also fulfilling this need of doing something unusual. Like one other unusual thing that I did with Kfir Elias, my co-author, we wrote a paper about the economics of bodybuilding. It has nothing to do with COVID, but you can imagine that it's the sort of thing that you do when things really have to be very bad for you to want to write a model of the economics of bodybuilding. So the book was another expression of this desire to do something unusual.
Okay, that sounds like a interesting paper to read. I haven't read it.
So it's, I mean, the thing we're going to talk about in this interview is going to be about surrendering and giving up. That paper is another act of surrender. It was started as a joke, but then we turned it into a serious paper about organizational economics, actually. So you can try to read the paper about bodybuilding, but it's not the way it came out eventually.
Sounds almost like we have to do another interview at some point
Exactly.
about that paper. But today we want to talk about chapter 8 of your upcoming book, which is the story behind one of your own papers called Search Design and Broad Matching that you wrote together with Kvi Elias, whom you just mentioned already. And you use this as an example of how dominant paradigms in economics shape how researchers approach questions. So could you again briefly explain what the question of the paper is and how you initially thought about this and tried to approach this question?
Okay, so almost all of the chapters in the book are not about my own work. They're about other people's work, really, like established classics. In two chapters, I use my own work to illustrate the theme, a cultural theme. So this chapter is called From Competitive Equilibrium to Mechanism Design in 18 Months. So it's a long title. It's by far the longest title of chapters in the book. And I chose to focus on this chapter in our chat because, as you noted, this podcast is really about, in some sense, the behind the scenes of doing work. And this chapter is about something that happened behind the scenes. And it has two levels. The meta cultural level is about what happens when, you have an economic problem that you're interested in, and you're kind of aware that there are at least two methodologies or styles you could use to attack the problem. There is a fashionable one and an unfashionable one, an old-fashioned one. And you sort of deliberately choose to use the unfashionable way. And so you kind of deliberately try to swim against the tide in some sense, and then it doesn't work. So you give up and switch to the dominant paradigm. So it's kind of a way of demonstrating how powerful the cultural trends, the fads are in terms of shaping what we can and cannot do. So this is like the cultural theme. And more specifically about mechanism design, the fact that we try to do something in almost an anti-mechanism design attitude, but then in the end we switched and we accepted the mechanism design approach. It gave us a view of some of the distortions and biases in the mechanism design approach that maybe you're less aware of these biases when you just immediately accept this approach. So that's the cultural aspect of this chapter. Now, but of course, then there's the economic substance, and I do try to talk about the economic substance. I'll try to do it very quickly, because that's not the center of this interview, but I will say a few words about the substantive economic question that we addressed in that chapter. It's essentially a model of keyword pricing of search engines. Now, the starting point was that if you look at the literature on search engine pricing, almost all of it, even today, has a very limited and I would say primitive view of what search engines do. It almost reduces them to classified guides, what in my I'm pretty old now, so in my generation, we used to call it the yellow pages. So it's like assuming that the user has a very, very clear idea of what they want. So they say what they want, say a mountain bike with a certain model. And then all they need is just a list of providers. Could be also content providers, doesn't have to be commercial products. And then you just get the list, and then you can browse through the list, maybe searching for the cheapest alternative. But search engines are much more interesting than that. What they do is that they take a query that can be very vague and imprecise because the user may not know how to describe what they want. They sort of know what they want in the sense that if they see it, they will recognize whether they want it or not. Like, for example, suppose that you look for a piece of music, you heard it on the radio, and some users will be able to recognize the artist or maybe even the name of the song, and then they'll be able to write it down in the query. But other people, they don't know the other artists. They can barely hum the tune. So how do you turn that into a query? Even if you have Shazam or something like that, it's a very vague query. And what search engines do, and LLMs these days do it even better, is that they take a very vague query and they turn it into an answer. And the answer, in the case of search engines, is a pool of alternatives, and then you can browse. But that's what search engines do. They have this thing that we at Fear and I call the vocabulary expansion function. And we wanted to focus on that function. And our economic question was, could the competitive market fulfill this function? Like, if Google ditched their organic search engine, which runs on some very sophisticated central algorithm, if they completely got rid of that, and all we had left was the sponsored search, which is based on competitive bidding, will it be able to mimic a successful search engine in the sense that it would fulfill this vocabulary expansion role? So that was the question. Can you do informational retrieval with the market? So let me just like very, very, very quickly describe our like initial approach. So we wanted to use competitive equilibrium approach, and we'll talk later about why. So the way we conceptualized it was that there is a set of keywords and advertisers can bid for those keywords. But if there is a very competitive market, then they're effectively price takers. So each keyword will have a price and each advertiser chooses a bundle of keywords to pay for. Pay the market price for these for this bundle. And there is an underlying rule that is going to say, if you paid the price for a keyword, that's going to map into entering search pools of consumers depending on their queries. If you pay for a certain keyword, that sort of translates into probability of entering various search pools induced by various types of user queries. And so in equilibrium, it's very simple. As an advertiser, you're going to choose the bundle of keywords optimally in terms of maximizing the value of transactions that you expect, minus the price that you pay for the keywords. That's condition number one, just subjective optimization by advertisers. And the second condition is zero profits. That was like the reduced form way of representing very strong competitive pressures. So that was our notion of a competitive equilibrium in the market for keywords. And what we got was some kind of qualified welfare theorems, because the question was, can a competitive equilibrium in the market for keywords mimic an ideal search engine? Well, yes, under certain conditions, which I can elaborate on a little bit.
Okay, so you had your approach and you wrote it down and it worked and you got some results, but you already mentioned this. Still, the current version of the paper does not use this competitive equilibrium approach, but it uses the mechanism design approach. So could you talk a bit about what made you change your mind and redo the paper with this new approach?
Yeah, so the story of the chapter is this transition from using one approach to another approach. And can we learn something more general? Because it's not really interesting per se, but can we learn something more general and interesting about our field because of this story? So there are actually two questions. Why did we start with competitive equilibrium knowingly? And why did we cave in the end and switch to mechanism design? So let me start with the first question. Why did we do it? So there are two serious answers and one silly answer. But the silly answer is as important as the serious ones. The serious answers is, first, we realized that we really want to zoom in on this vocabulary expansion role of search engines. All the literature neglected that, and we wanted to zoom in on that. And so in theory, when you do theory, you realize that, you know, if you want to zoom in on something, you need to zoom out elsewhere, because otherwise you get something that's completely unmanageable or intractable. So we decided to zoom out in our approach to the market. Mechanism design is very microscopic. It looks at the market from up close, whereas the competitive equilibrium approach is more telescopic. So that was one methodological reason. Another one was that we sort of intuited that the mechanism design approach would have certain biases and distortions in this case. We didn't really know what those biases were, but we sort of felt like it would be the wrong take. And that's something that I'm going to get to later. So those were the serious reasons. Now the childish reason, but this is very important because, again, we're trying to learn something about how theory is done, like behind the scenes, those kind of things that you don't get to see in the published paper. So when we started thinking about this, the paper came out in 2016, but we really started thinking about this around 2008. And that was really a peak time for research on keyword options. There was a very influential paper by Schwartz, Edelman, and Ostrowski about keyword options. And it was really a hot topic, and especially in the community that is known as econ CS, like people who are either both computer scientists and economic theorists, or they hang out together. Some of this hanging out takes place at places like Microsoft Research, those kind of research labs of the internet giants. Now, and some of the people who were involved in this research, they later became very important people in the business side of those companies. Like even Schwartz himself, I think these days, or maybe recently, he was chief economist at Microsoft. So these were very important people on the business side. Now, Kfir and I, we knew we're not going to be the chief economist of anything, not even a grocery store. So it's like we saw, okay, so those cool kids are going to do auction theory, and then they're going to enter the executive suite of Google, make tons of money. And we're going to be those uncool kids at the party, like wallflowers. And then we're going to do this unfashionable thing and let the cool kids do the fashionable thing. So this kind of attitude, we were, of course, very aware of this, the childishness and silliness of this attitude, but it was really a motivator. You know, you're in the creative business. So those kind of silly emotional things can be good motivators as long as you're aware of that. It was childish, but it was also very self-aware. So that's why we wanted to do competitive equilibrium. We deliberately kind of associated the mechanism design auction theory approach with the cool kids, chief economist crowd. And we wanted to do something different. But then the question is, then why did we switch? Why did we give up? And this is where I think that the first cultural lesson that I think is interesting, I want to go a little bit more deeply into that. What happens is that we are very pleased with what we got, and then we try to communicate what we did. You know, you give seminars, you have 15-minute one-on-one chats, and then we saw that it doesn't work. We just couldn't get this across. Sometimes it doesn't work, and you know that it's just that you had a bad day or you're just not clear enough. This happens. But sometimes you sort of feel that there's something more fundamental going on there. And I think this fundamental thing is interesting about our professional culture. Economic theorists have become extremely efficient in communicating ideas. And the reason is that we use game theory. Game theory is an amazingly expressive language. It gives us a sense, maybe it's a false sense, that give me any interaction on Earth, maybe even in outer space, I can write down a game form for that. And so we, you know, you start telling a story, you give them all those primitives, you're essentially describing a game form. And we do that very efficiently, especially when you don't need to notate it. You know, if you have a one-on-one chat, I don't know, with the seminar speaker, and you go for coffee together, you can describe the game form very quickly. And then what you do is that you take a solution concept off the shelf. So like it's two-stage procedure, describe them all those primitives, then take a solution concept off the shelf. You select it from a very small set of solution concepts like Nash, Perfect Bayesian, and nobody has to discuss that. You know, they take it for granted that you can take it off the shelf, and they're not going to give you a hard time for doing it. They're not going to ask questions. So it's super efficient. Now, competitive equilibrium, initially in the 50s, it was defined for a very, very, very narrow set of environments. So if you want to use a competitive equilibrium-like model in a new environment, in our case, it was a market for keywords, you kind of need to introduce a new solution concept. You can't just plug and play. You have to introduce a solution concept. So when you describe this work to somebody else, you present the primitives, but you also need to present the solution concept. An amazing precedent for that kind of procedure, which I, by the way, also discuss in the book in another chapter, is the Rothschild-Stiglitz model of competitive screening, which is one of the greatest pieces in economic theory ever. What they did was they presented a setup of like a competitive market, insurance market with adverse selection. And then they invented the solution concept, and then they showed the implications. It's an amazing paper. It's a classic. We tried to do something in that spirit, of course, not at that level, but in that spirit of presenting a primitive, the setup of the market for keyword, and then introducing a solution concept. But then the way, when you start presenting this to people, it's like Kahneman's system one, system two. They switch from system one to system two. They raise their defenses. They start being very, very vigilant and critical, and they start asking questions about the solution concept. They don't take it for granted. That slows things down tremendously, and it also makes it a harder sell. So I think that's an interesting lesson about the way our professional culture is organized, that we've kind of developed this method of primitives, solution concept. The primitives are where you introduce the new stuff, but it's very efficient, and then the solution concept, off the shelf, no questions asked. By the way, in macro, for example, in macro, when you read a macro paper, it's kind of the model and the solution concept are sometimes blended. They just introduce equations as they go along. And there isn't this clear separation between presenting the model and then applying the solution concept. So I think it's interesting that we have converged to this equilibrium and this huge distaste that we have for presenting models that also involve a new solution concept. unless the solution concept is the main dish, is the main point. And it's very rare to see papers where there's a substantive economic question that you're interested in, but you attack it by introducing a new solution concept. And so we saw that there was this huge friction. And so we gave up. We said, okay, now by now, we know how to rewrite our exercise in the mechanism design language. So we're going to do it. We did it. It was an easy rewrite. It had pros, it had cons. We can talk about this. We submitted this for publication. It was the first submission. Nothing ever goes very smoothly, but it was relatively smooth. We managed to publish it in the AER, American Economic Review. So it's a good landing spot. So it was a happy ending in this sense. So we gave up, but at least we got the top 5 publication.
Yeah, thanks for sharing this. It sounds really interesting because normally you would assume that if you write a model and everything checks out and your model works and you get interesting results, then it shouldn't really matter which approach you use as long as it's a valid approach. But it seems to be, like you said, that it matters not only to get the results, but also to get them in a way that people can kind of easily understand so that they don't focus really on the question and not too much on the methodology.
But in this particular paper, we were very self-aware from the start about this dilemma between using competitive equilibrium or mechanism design. And again, the reason I call the chapter From Competitive Equilibrium to Mechanism Design 18 Months is that obviously over decades, there's been this amazing transition from a view of markets that is grounded in competitive equilibrium to a view of markets that is more like engineering, which views markets through the prism of mechanism or market design. It's a huge shift. It's very important. So our little story, because we were very aware of the applicability of these two big methodologies to our particular problem, that's why I think it makes it an interesting story.
And you mentioned earlier that when you started out with the competitive equilibrium approach, you had some thoughts that there would be some downsides to using mechanism design instead. Now that you wrote the mechanism design version of the paper, do you think those were warranted?
So first of all, one good thing about mechanism design, it enabled us to ask questions that would be nonsensical in the competitive equilibrium case. And so we had new questions and new results. That was a good thing. First of all, heuristically, the fact that we decided to ignore mechanism design and do competitive equilibrium was a good thing heuristically, because even if in the end we could translate things to the language of mechanism design, it was a good idea, I think, to start with competitive equilibrium. And by the way, there are a lot of top market design researchers who go these days who go back and forth between a competitive equilibrium approach and a market design approach. It's not that rare that people, even in market design, they do realize the value of thinking about problems from these two perspectives. So I describe these things antagonistically, but that's part of the drama of the story. I want to tell a story, so I tell it as a story of antagonism. But obviously, there are researchers who fuse these two approaches in a harmonious way, not in an antagonistic way. Now, but I think the second interesting cultural lesson that I want to convey is that we did manage to see a certain kind of distortions and biases once we moved from competitive equilibrium to mechanism design. And I think what happens often with mechanism design, it's not a logical necessity of mechanism design as a methodology, but de facto, it's what you tend to see, is that you sort of empathize with the designer. The designer typically has a simple objective. And what you do as an analyst is that you identify with that objective and you relentlessly and single-mindedly pursue that objective. And then you sort of throw out all sorts of constraints. You're kind of relentless. You're going to help this designer maximize their profits or maximize effort or maximize efficiency. And you have kind of no inhibitions in how you do that. Let me make this concrete in terms of our story. So in our story, we did competitive equilibrium, and one of the conditions in competitive equilibrium was that advertisers earn zero profits. So one aspect of a competitive equilibrium outcome in our model was that advertiser surplus, like the firm's surplus on the supply side, you get full surplus extraction because they make zero profits. At the same time, we asked, could this be a good outcome for consumers? So there were these two criteria or two objectives: extracting the firm's surplus and maximizing consumer welfare. Now, when you do mechanism design, starting out with these two twin objectives is kind of weird. You could do it, But normally you wouldn't do it. And if you did that, referees would raise an eyebrow and ask you, why are you doing this? They sort of, you feel pressured. Again, it's not a logical necessity, but you're sort of pressured to assume a simpler, more conventional, and like one objective for the designer. And in our case, it would have been a very natural objective, maximizing profits. And then if you maximize profits, then you would want to maximize surplus. And then fully extract it like a monopolist. And so you would extract the advertiser's surplus and you would maximize consumer welfare and then you would extract consumer welfare. But then here's the thing. How would you extract consumer welfare? With access fees. So you need to charge consumers for the right to use the search engine. We don't see that in reality. Kfir and I didn't want to introduce access fees on the consumer side. There is no reason to do that because descriptively, for various reasons, it doesn't happen in reality. Why would you want to make that part of the model? Moreover, in order to make everything self-consistent from a mechanism design point of view, you need consumers to be rational and forward-looking. You know, if you decide whether you want to pay the access fee, you need to be forward-looking and anticipate the quality of search that you're going to get. If I'm going to sign up for a search engine, I need to have a good prediction of the quality of search experience that I'm going to get there. So these two components, rational expectations for consumers and access fees, we didn't want to introduce those things in the first place, but now we were kind of nudged, not forced, but nudged toward that. And that's a distortion. And more broadly, the distortion is that you really end up behaving like what you care about in this world is maximizing Google's profits. We didn't want to maximize Google's profits. We're not employees by Google. And again, we started out this project resenting, in some sense, not really resenting, but sort of assuming this kind of antagonistic attitude to those hotshots who maximize Google's profits and then they become chief economists. And so we didn't want to do that. And then, but we ended up doing that, effectively asking questions like, what would you do if you would want to maximize Google's profits? We didn't want that. We wanted to ask the question, are market mechanisms good at managing information retrieval? It's a different kind of questions. Suggesting different follow-up questions. It's a very different kind of research that you do if you start asking questions, how would you tweak your auction design to maximize Google's profits when consumers are not very good at saying what they want? So that's a distortion. And by the way, we see that distortion elsewhere in the mechanism design approach. Think about principal agent models. Principal agent models, you very often try to use them as a model of labor relations, you know, relationships between employers and employees. But when you analyze the principal agent model, it's like you empathize with the employer. And by the way, in these models, the employer is like a really horrible boss, trying to maximize the workers' efforts and fully extracting their surplus. That's like a bad boss. You wouldn't want to have this kind of boss. Now, in our models, we act like bad bosses. Why would we want to do that? It creates biases because you end up asking questions like, how would I act if I were a bad boss? It's not necessarily the kind of question you want to ask if you analyze labor relations. So those are the biases that I think we intuited at the beginning, and our worries were confirmed by the distortions that we ended up seeing in our research. It's not first order distortion, but it is a distortion nonetheless, and I think it's interesting to bring that out, and that's one of the, like, again, the cultural themes of this chapter is that highlighting this aspect of de facto mechanism design practice, this relentless pursuit or this relentless and single-minded pursuit of the designer's objective. That's something that we were able to see more clearly when we transitioned.
So just speculating, but it sounds really also like it contributes to the communication problem that economics maybe has also to the outside world, because I feel like many people think economists are these people who really like sympathize with big corporations and employers, and they don't care about ordinary people and workers. And in a sense, like the way we set up our mechanism design approaches supports this view. If you read an economic paper, it's always like, okay, how can the employer extract all the surplus from the
Yeah.
worker?
So political bias of economic theory, it's obviously a theme that one would want to think about when writing about the culture of economic theory. I didn't have anything interesting to say about that, so it may remain in the background, but it's not something that I talk about explicitly in the book. And again, I didn't want to use the instrument of access fees, but I ended up assuming access fees when I once I did mechanism design. It's like this when you analyze markets, for example, or institutions, sometimes you want to assume some limitations of the instruments that the agents can use for various reasons. And sometimes it's because realistically you see that, you know, there are certain restrictions on the instruments that people use. And you don't know necessarily why there are these restrictions, but you don't feel like you necessarily want to expand them. So you just assume those restrictions. But when you do mechanism design, you can't just restrict instruments. It's poor form. Unless you have a very, very good reason to rule out an instrument, integer gain in Maskin's classic implementation theory paper. Nobody uses integer gains, but when you do an implementation theory paper, then introducing an integer gain is something that you might consider as relevant.
So given what you said just now, and you also actually write this in your chapter, it sounds like you still think for the questions you were interested in answering, the competitive equilibrium approach would have been more interesting than the mechanism design approach. But do you, now that you have kind of written both versions of the paper and try to communicate both versions of the paper, still think the impact overall is now lower that you switch the approach? Or do you think the benefits that people can understand it easier kind of outweigh these issues, that it kind of focuses you to talk about things that you're not really interested talking about?
Yeah, I mean, impact is a big word, and most of us have, most of the time we have zero impact. It's very rare that you write those papers and you think about long-term impact. And not only do you think about that, but you also feel like you know what you need to do in order to generate that impact. Most of the time, you just try to get published. So in this sense, it was success. We managed to communicate our idea in a more effective way, and we got published, well published. It is still that I think that for the kind of questions I was interested in, like, can the market do a good job with information retrieval? And by the way, it doesn't have to be search on the internet. It could be searching inside your email inbox. Can the market do a good job? That kind of question became dissolved somehow by what we did. So I regret that, but not in the sense of impact, because I don't think that anything, I mean, thinking about impact is such a low probability event that it's not really helpful.
I see. But it still sounds like this kind of tension that, on the one hand, if you use standard research designs that everyone is familiar with, like you mentioned, the standard game theory solution concepts, then communicating will be very efficient. People don't need to spend too much time understanding your theory. They can understand your results easily. So they can maybe focus more time on doing their own research or learning things faster in general. But also it kind of forces you or nudges you into certain directions to answer certain questions that maybe are not the ones that you really want to answer. So it sounds like that in the ideal world, we should to some degree prefer using standard methods that people are familiar with if there's no huge downside, so just because it kind of makes everything more efficient. But at the same time, of course, if we focus too much on that, then there are just some questions that we can't properly address, or maybe we write less interesting papers. So I'm wondering, where do you think we are currently on this scale? Do we punish unusual approaches too much? Or is it, in a sense, good for how the profession works that you really need to justify yourself if you want to use a novel approach that might be harder to understand for people?
So let's distinguish between two levels. You know, when there's an interesting major conceptual innovation, there's always going to be resistance. We're all people and we have inertia. I don't think economists, and certainly not economic theorists, are worse than others. I think we're actually open to conceptual innovation. We're curious. The book is called The Curious Culture of Economic Theory. I think we are open-minded. So I'm not going to be down on theory. I think when an innovation arrives, people are actually welcoming. And there's a separate question of whether we provide the conditions for the frequent arrival of novel ideas. But when the idea arrives, I think we are quite hospitable. There is another level, which is, what about second level or second degree innovation, more ancillary things? I mean, the story that I told in this chapter was not about the major conceptual innovation. It was just about using an unfashionable or old-fashioned approach to a problem. So it wasn't really new. But what I think there is, we do have a problem with, we over-canonize ancillary assumptions. And we are too rigid in the sense of allowing people to explore little deviations at that level. One book chapter is called Cover Versions, which is precisely about that. There's rigidity and over-canonization of small assumptions. Think about like exponential discounting in repeated games. Most repeated games papers these days assume exponential discounting as the method of aggregating payoffs over time. and common discount factor. And that's because it's very, very convenient and you can use dynamic programming methods. In the 70s, when people wrote in a more pioneering way about repeated games, they used various criteria, like overtaking. It's another criterion for aggregating payoffs over time. Now, these days, if you're going to write a paper that is motivated by an economic question, and you're going to use repeated game methodology, but you're going to feel that, hey, actually, discounting is really awkward in this setting. It's just intractable. Why don't I use overtaking? You're going to get huge pushback. So there is this kind of, again, canonization of small assumptions, like ways of doing things that are not fundamental to the problem. And again, overtaking is something that has been done. You're not really innovating. So I think there we do see a lot of rigidity, and I bemoan that, and I devoted a chapter to that kind of phenomenon.
But on the broader level, so in terms of like really disruptive new ideas, you would say that at least economic theory does not suffer too much from this issue that people are kind of conservative and want to kind of ask the same question in different ways again and again?
I don't think we're conservative, but I do think there is a question of whether, you know, I think if Ken Arrow is reborn today, obviously it's going to be harder to do a Ken Arrow these days than the 1950s, because it's a more mature and specialized field and it's harder to innovate. But the Ken Arrow genes are still out there. This kind of talent exists. I don't know what they're doing. Those people with the kind of genius for conceptual innovation married to very good technical skills, this kind of combination. Those people are out there. They didn't disappear. The question is whether economic theory attracts them and nurtures them. When the idea arrives, I think people will love it. But the question is whether we provide conditions for this idea to arrive. And here I'm not so sure. And if you think about graduate programs, you know, suppose that there are Ken Arrows, the Meyersons and Krebs of the world, they have both a genius for conceptual innovation as well as a genius for the technical part. But below the stratosphere, there is substitution. And, you know, you could be very good at the technical level or very good conceptually in terms of like taking a verbal idea and turn it into a formal model, but you're not necessarily a good technician. Now, if you take a student in a grad program, the question is, and it's an empirical question, but I still feel like I have an intuition of how things work. I fear that the kind of conceptual innovator type might feel intimidated by the technicians and somehow be crowded out. I'm not sure this happens. I worry that this happens. And if it happens, that's not so good for economic theory. So it's an empirical question. I sort of feel like this is happening. I don't think that technicians are ever intimidated by the conceptual innovators. I think it's one-way relationship.
Yeah, sounds very reasonable to me also, because probably you're not going to be a huge conceptual innovator in the first year of your PhD program because you don't know stuff yet. But technical skills may be also easier to verify in young academics that...
I think you see, I disagree. I think you can see the talent. Nobody expects you to reinvent the wheel when you start, but you can show talent. You can show the talent. I have examples with my own students. I mean, if I had more time, I could describe it. You can see the talent. It doesn't have to be a breakthrough, but you can see the talent. The question is whether this talent is nurtured or whether those people feel intimidated and crowded out.
So, the paper that we just talked about is co-author, was one of your longtime co-authors, but actually you have also written some single-authored papers after your PhD, whereas I think most people write the job market paper and then never write a single-authored paper again in most fields of economics. So if you kind of come up with a new research idea on your own, it doesn't really come out of a conversation with someone. How do you decide whether you just want to write it down on your own or whether you want to bring in co-authors?
I don't have a recipe. I agree that it's pretty rare these days for people to do solo work. I think the interesting thing about solo work is that sometimes an idea develops, but it's not really ready for verbalization. It's still too vague. Doesn't mean that it's not a good idea. It doesn't mean that it's not being developed. But the moment you verbalize it and make it more explicit, then there's a sense in which you sort of kill it or kill its potential. Sometimes, not for every project. And, you know, when I have a relationship like I have with Kfir, which is like a married couple, you know, we've been writing together dozens of papers for many years, then it's much easier to communicate at this kind of semi-verbal level, and you understand what your friend is trying to say, even though he's saying something very, very unclear. But the thing about this solo works is that you're able to cultivate an idea below the threshold of verbalization, and then it's a different kind of project. And that's why I think doing solo work is valuable occasionally. Of course, it's much less fun. It's fun to work together with a friend. You tell jokes, and also practically, you sit in a cafe and chat. You don't want to be caught in a cafe talking to yourself. So there are downsides to doing solo work, but there is this weird upside that I think is underappreciated. And of course, I understand the material incentives for doing collaborative work, which probably have increased over time.
Yeah, I guess, if you have many courses, you do a lot less work. But if you publish a paper alone, at least my intuition would be that you don't get much more credit for a solo top five than you would get for one with two, three courses.
Exactly.
So then from a pure publication perspective, it just doesn't pay to work on stuff on your own. Yeah.
I agree.
In this book, but also over the years, you have been an observer and critique about how we do economic theory. And actually, some other people we have also interviewed on this podcast, like Ariel Rubinstein and Tzachi Gabor, who also are in a similar space. So there seems to be many Israeli people in this space. Do you think this is kind of a random pattern that we picked up here? Or is that maybe something related to the way that PhDs are trained in Israel, or the culture more general?
General cultural explanations, I try to avoid them because they're too easy, essentialist explanations. I think what happened in the case of Israel is that I don't know the history too well, but my understanding is that both Menachem Yahari and Yisrael Aumann, they were active in Jerusalem in the 60s, and they're both towering figures. They're really, really strong researchers and also very charismatic. And they are, at least in the case, certainly in the case of Aumann and partly in the case of Yahari, they worked very well in the foundational part of the spectrum of economic theory, which cultivates links to, say, philosophy, for example, or math. And they also founded the Center for Rationality in Jerusalem, which kind of institutionalized this kind of relationship. And they were very strong and charismatic, so they attracted like-minded people. And that sort of developed a strong local culture, which is mainly in the foundational part of theory, less so in the applied side. And this kind of local cultures, they thrive for a while, and they persist, and they have long-lasting effects. And I think more generally, having strong local cultures is very important. Just a few weeks ago, there was an interview with Steve Levitt, who was very widely publicized. And he talked about the weird, for better or worse, strange and unusual culture that they had at the Department of Economics in Chicago when he joined. And then I spoke with people and I learned that other places had distinctive cultures, local cultures. And then things became much more homogenized over the years. And I think that's a shame. It's a loss. So having strong local cultures that are distinctive, that's a good thing, and we should have more of that.
That sounds very interesting, even that we to some degree still have this today. I don't have data on this, but my feelings, for example, are that like the German-speaking area is kind of focused a lot more, for example, on experiments than, say, the U.S.
That's exactly the other example that I had in mind was experimental economics. Why was it in the German system, including Switzerland, say, why was it the case that there are such important centers in experimental economics? I guess it has something to do with the way academic careers are structured in the German system or have been structured in the German system, which is different from the UK-US system. So I guess that would be an explanation. It gives experimental work a comparative advantage. And that fosters a strong local tradition, a strong local culture. And I think it's important to have those cultures.
Yeah. So maybe to move a bit towards the end of the interview, I would like to ask you a bit about how you work and maybe also your thoughts on the process of building economic models. So how do you usually work? So you mentioned with co-authors, you spend lots of time talking in cafes. Do you also work in cafes? Or what makes you productive?
Cafes, airports, trains, less productive at the office. I need some kind of minimal noise level around me, I guess, and that helps me be productive. But that with this business, most days you fail, right? You try a modeling approach and it doesn't work. It's trivial or it's intractable. Or you try to prove something, it doesn't work. So most days you feel like a failure, and so you don't feel productive. So I can't really know what makes me productive because most days I end up feeling unproductive. So I have no idea what makes me productive.
I mean, this seems to work out in the end often enough. But in terms of economic theory, do you think nowadays grad school programs prepare students well to be a consumer and also producer of good economic theory? Or is there maybe kind of a shift away from economic theory?
In terms of theory itself, we discussed that already, this tension between, you know, training people to be good at the conceptual level or good at the technical level. And we discussed that tension, which again, at the highest level, there doesn't need to be a tension. It would be a synthesis. But once you move below the stratosphere, it becomes sometimes there is some kind of substitution going on. And we already talked about that, that it's an empirical question of whether we're in a good equilibrium. In terms of the status of theory vis-a-vis the rest of the profession, I don't have anything smart to say. I mean, in the book, I describe at the beginning of the book the familiar path of how theorists were kings and then they were dethroned and the sociology of that. But we sort of, maybe we return to our rightful place at the margin of the profession. We should realize that we can't all be at the center of the stage, and we need to live with that and make the most of them. That's fine. Not everybody wants to be, just like in a football team, you can't all be Ronaldos, right? So there should be some Rodri's around, and they're very, very good and important. So it's fine. The Ronaldos end up getting paid more and they win the Ballon d'Or, but the Rodri's are also very important. So I think that's a good analogy.
And coming back to the thing that some paradigms are really very popular and people always use the same approach. This is maybe also like a failure to some degree of grad school, that if in grad school you only learn, if you have this type of question, use mechanism design and this is how it works, and we never really teach, okay, but there are also other approaches that you can use, that this maybe strengthens this culture?
I think what strengthens it is that the regular seminars, they're always dominated by the current fads. And so you get a massive overrepresentation of certain research directions. I think a good antidote, I received that advice when I was a student and I'm trying to impart it to students, is to form reading groups. And it's a good antidote, I think, is to form reading groups with friends, with fellow students, and read together older papers. Not the paper that was presented last week in the seminar, but older papers. And I think that's a good antidote. And so I recommend that. I think that's something that students would be, it would be good for students if they did that.
Yeah, that sounds like really good advice. So I also got the advice to form a reading group, and we had one at Oxford, but I think we mostly read their working papers really and kind of focused
on. So I think a good a mix,
anyway.
Reading, I think a mixture that also includes old papers. Now, of course, I need to define what I mean by old. It could be 5 years ago, it could be 50 years ago, but you know what I mean. Having some kind of spread, the realization the theory didn't start last year.
Yeah, do you have any kind of thoughts or advice about if someone wants to become a theorist, how do they learn economic modeling? Because, I mean, in the finished paper, you barely see the proofs, right? They're somewhere deep in the appendix, and you definitely don't see what kind of approaches people use to end up with the final version of the paper. So how would one learn this?
I don't have any smart thing to say. The usual things, osmosis and mentoring, you absorb that from your peers and from the seminars. And you, the reading group, and from your supervisor. I don't have anything. I think it's magical, you know, and also it's a question of talent. Some people have a talent for doing formal theory and some people don't. I don't have any practical advice other than these usual traditional methods of osmosis and mentoring.
I see. And more broadly, if you could give any kind of single piece of advice to a young researcher working on their first big project where they take the lead, what would that be? Or do we have something there?
I'll do even better. I'll give two pieces of advice. One piece of advice is that be very careful about the advice that comes from very top people. Very often, the very, very top people, they love giving advice and everybody wants to hear their advice. But bear in mind that when they give this advice, they tend to think about the top student at MIT. And the advice that they give might be very good advice for the top student at MIT, but most of us are not the top student at MIT, and so we should be careful about that kind of advice. Now, the second piece of advice, again, not totally sure of that advice, but I think it might be valuable, is that when you start doing things, you're almost bound to do a tweak of something that is already existing. It's with 99%, that's what you're going to end up doing. But there is a difference between starting out as a tweak, like taking the paper that Professor X presented last week and say, I'm going to do a tweak. That's one thing. Another thing is starting from that some genuinely economic idea of taking from your taking inspiration from your actual everyday life or from reading something in the papers, on Twitter. And so it would be a genuine idea. It could even be a very ambitious idea. And then the great thing about grad school is that you have a supervisor. The supervisor will help you turning that idea into a tweak because he knows the literature, he knows the ropes. Use that resource. And if the supervisor is too busy, switch to another supervisor who's not too busy and use the supervisor to take a genuinely economic idea and turn that into a tweak. I think it will have a lasting effect. It will be a motivator. It will give meaning to what you do. It will be like a North Star. Of course, what you do in the end will be very likely to be very far from the original motivation, but it will be different from doing a tweak that started out as a tweak.
Okay, then thank you so much for doing the interview with us. I think I learned a lot. It was very interesting, and I hope our listeners will also learn a lot. And then we're at the end of this episode. Thanks also to our listeners, and I hope you tune in for the next episode.